You're listening to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. Hello, everyone. Welcome to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. I'm John Cunn. It's going to be a solo pod today as Lee Keller is out. He's actually at Disney World, so if you bump into him, say hi and thank him for the fantasy advice. But yeah, today's show, we're still covering the latest news around baseball, talking about player performances, and just discussing changes in pitch shapes with Michael Barker of Pitcherless. So that'll be fun. And then obviously it just gives some streaming options for the week to wrap everything up. Before we get into this episode, just want to remind you that you can all follow our podcast on Twitter at ThisWeekPL. You can send us your fantasy baseball requests to our email at thisweekplpod@gmail.com. Lastly, just make sure that you subscribe or follow our podcast on whatever streaming platform you listen to our podcast on, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. We're on all of them. So just make sure you subscribe, leave a 5-star review if you enjoy listening to us. It's been about a month and a half into the baseball season, so things are kind of getting closer to what we are expecting to see. Of course, I'm sure not many people were expecting to see the Yankees at the bottom of the AL East or the Rays at the top of the AL East. I'm sure that wasn't exactly expected, but Detroit is somehow second in the AL Central right now. The Mets are one game above 500. Don't have Lee here in today to talk about that, but obviously probably a little disappointing for them. Pittsburgh is in first place. That's always fun. St. Louis is currently the worst team in the NL Central and the NL in general. So yeah, just some weird things. But in fantasy baseball, you know, we don't care about standings. We just care if our players are doing well. Well, we're going to start with MLB news since the last podcast. There was a lot of injuries. I actually didn't really even talk about all the small things that happened throughout the week that prevented people from playing games, but maybe just what's going to affect the next week of games. I'm going to start with Kenta Maeda of the Twins. He was placed on the 15-day IL with a right tricep strain. Again, it's not directly related to the part of his elbow that underwent Tommy John surgery, so the Twins are just thinking it's a muscle issue. He'll be back soon-ish. Christian Pache of the Phillies was placed on the 10-day IL with a torn meniscus in his right knee, but the Phillies are hopeful he can return this season. It's probably going to be a 3 to 4 month recovery period, so we'll see what they can do for the former top prospect. Brooks Raley of the Mets was placed on the 15-day IL with left elbow inflammation. This basically solidifies that David Robertson and Adam Ottavino are going to be the top two options out of the bullpen for the Mets for the foreseeable future. Tyler Glasnow of the Rays started a minor league rehab assignment, went a couple innings and got 4 strikeouts, I believe. So good to see him back. Basically, that minor league rehab assignment starts the 20-day clock for him to return to the major. So he should be back within 3 weeks. Jacob deGrom of the Rangers was placed on the 15-day IL with right elbow inflammation. The Rangers are saying it's just a precautionary thing, but they also said he was going to be out for a few weeks. Just kind of a maybe mixed message there. He did start playing catch later in the week, but still no, you know, baseball activities or things like that. Adam Wainwright of the Cardinals will be starting on Saturday after starting the season on the injured list. He did go 5 2/3 innings with 9 strikeouts in his last minor league rehab assignment. So we'll see if he'll be able to bring that success to the Cardinals because they sorely need it. Luis Severino of the Yankees is on track to rejoin the starting rotation in 2-3 weeks, according to manager Aaron Boone. He's expected to start in a minor league rehab game after being out since late March with a right lat strain. Obviously some needed help for the Yankees rotation as well. Chad Kuhl of the Nationals was placed on the 15-day IL with right foot metatarsalgia, which basically is just a big toe sprain. I could have just said that earlier, but yeah, Chad Kuhl not going to be pitching for the next couple weeks. Bryce Harper of the Phillies basically had a modern medical miracle because he returned from Tommy John surgery, which he had back in November. Initially, they thought that he wouldn't be back until the All-Star break, but he's played in a couple games so far, gone 3-for-7 last I checked. So, you know, not bad. Pretty solid stuff. Kyle Farmer of the Twins started a minor league rehab assignment this week. He was on the injured list after getting hit in the face by a pitch, needed surgery to repair some facial cuts, thankfully no fractures to his jaw, so he should be back in the majors in a couple weeks. Cal Hendricks of the Cubs made another minor league rehab start. He should be back soon, but the Cubs want to build him up fully before he's back in Chicago. Nicky Lopez of the Royals was placed on the 10-day IL with appendicitis. The big news here, though, was that the Royals called up their top prospect, Michael Garcia. So look out for Michael Garcia on the waiver wire. Daniel Lynch of the Royals made a minor league rehab start. Should be rejoining the Royals rotation in a few weeks. Hanser Alberto and Tim Anderson of the White Sox were both activated from the 10-day IL this week. Tim Anderson made a pretty big impact as soon as he came back. So both guys look healthy. Avisel Garcia of the Marlins was placed on the 10-day IL with left back tightness. He hasn't made too much of an impact this season, so don't expect this to change too much for the Marlins' offense. Jose Altuve of the Astros started fielding ground balls this week. Not swinging a bat yet, but he is still recovering from that broken right thumb that he suffered in the WBC. The expectation is that he'll be back in Houston in about a month, basically early June. Liam Hendricks of the White Sox was able to have a minor league rehab assignment this week, which is great news, obviously, coming back from that cancer diagnosis, and ultimately it's now in remission, which is great. The White Sox want him to have 4 to 5 appearances before coming back to the majors and should be on the roster within 3 weeks. Germán Márquez of the Rockies is going to undergo Tommy John surgery and hopes to be back by the start of the 2024 season. Jose Quijada of the Angels is also undergoing Tommy John surgery as well. Quijada was one of those setup men for Angels, was a good source of holds, unfortunate for him. And then, we all know Márquez. It just is unfortunate he pitches in Coors, but he's always been a decent pitcher. Maybe not for fantasy, but in real life. Carlos Carrasco of the Mets was able to make a rehab start, expected to join the rotation next week. I mentioned him a little bit later, but he goes against the Nationals. Even though it's a still ill and he doesn't really have a lot of strikeout potential, that could be an interesting matchup for you to start next week. Daniel Espino of the Guardians, who's arguably Cleveland's best pitching prospect and one of the better pitching prospects in baseball in general, is going to be out for a year after shoulder surgery. So this really doesn't affect most redraft leagues, but he's basically not expected to make an impact in Cleveland until 2025, probably. Garrett Cooper of the Marlins was placed on the 10-day IL with an ear infection. He had been mashing for them this year, so it's a little unfortunate for him. Pete Fairbanks of the Rays was placed on the 15th IL with right forearm inflammation. Thought it was just a reoccurrence of Raynaud's syndrome, which he had been dealing with last season, but it looks to be a little bit more severe. Expect Jason Adam to pick up more of the save opportunities now in Tampa Bay. Nestor Cortez for the Yankees was dealing with strep throat, which meant that his start got pushed back to Monday against the A's, but no further complications with that. Ranger Suarez of the Phillies made his final minor league rehab start, and he could be back next week after dealing with a left elbow strain. Jared Walsh of the Angels should be starting a minor league rehab assignment soon. He has been on the injured list due to headaches and insomnia, but it sounds like the treatment that he underwent worked. He's no longer dealing with those issues, so expect him to be back soon. Michael Harris II of Atlanta was removed from a game after jamming his knee trying to beat out an infield single. Atlanta says that he avoided serious injury. He won't be going on the IL, but he did miss a couple games, including just Friday's game. So just keep monitoring that and seeing if Atlanta decides to end up putting him on the injured list. His teammate Kyle Wright was placed on a 15-day IL due to right shoulder soreness. Not a great sign because he had shoulder inflammation to start the season, which was why he got put on the IL earlier in the season. So it's not great for Kyle Wright. The corresponding move was Dylan Dodd, who did get a quality start, so good for Dodd, but he immediately got sent down. So we'll see what goes on with that Atlanta rotation. Nolan Gorman of the Cardinals is currently day-to-day with lower back tightness, although I did believe he pinch hit. So it doesn't look too bad. Joe Musgrove of the Padres has a start push back to Sunday due to a blister on his foot, but at least it's not another trip to the IL or, just dropping a weight on your toe. Raisel Iglesias of Atlanta was activated from the 15-day IL. Happy dealing with shoulder inflammation. Adrian Minter had been the closer for the time being, but Iglesias should be the main guy now. Tyler O'Neill of the Cardinals was placed on the 10-day IL with a lower back strain. Carlos Rodon of the Yankees, dealing with some extra complications, will be getting a cortisone shot to kind of speed up the healing or just, help in the healing. But there's still no timetable for his return to the Yankees rotation. It's kind of crazy that he signed that big contract and he still hasn't made his Yankees debut. Kyle Isbell of the Royals was diagnosed with a grade 2 hamstring strain. He's going to miss 6 weeks. Tyler Molly of the Twins was initially placed on a 15-day IL, but was just transferred to the 60-day IL with an elbow impingement and a strained flexor. So just kind of unfortunate luck for Molly, who, you know, last season being traded from the Reds to the Twins, started dealing with some shoulder soreness that they really couldn't figure out what was going wrong. He said he was feeling good in spring training, and then, you know, this popped up, which isn't great. Trevor Larnach of the Twins was optioned back to the minors because the Twins are now calling up Alex Kirilloff. Larnach had started the season strong, but had been struggling recently. Pitchers were basically kind of figuring him out and only throwing him off-speed stuff or breaking stuff. He just wasn't as successful. Kirilloff, of course, former top 100 prospect. Legitimate power, just dealing with wrist injuries the past two seasons. So we'll see how Kirilloff does now in an everyday role for the Twins. Luis Garcia of the Astros is going to have to undergo Tommy John surgery, which is unfortunate. He had a rough start to the season, but he had looked like he was turning things around in his past couple starts. His most recent one was a gem, so it's really unfortunate for the Astros, and they're dealing with a lot of injuries in their rotation as well. Jake Berger of the White Sox was placed on the 10-day IL with a strained left oblique. He had been leading the team in home runs. Oblique injuries are weird, so we'll see how long he's out for. Max Muncy of the Dodgers left Friday's game with flu-like symptoms, but he should be back soon. No reason to worry here for the current league leader in home runs. And then Andrew McCutchen of the Pirates was scratched from Friday's game with a sprained left ankle. So just keep monitoring that if you have McCutchen on your teams. Well, that's it for injuries. Like we say every single time, there's just a lot of big names here, but it's good to see some guys coming back. Tyler Glass now for sure. He was at the top of the list for a lot of, Stuff Plus and PLV stuff. Obviously, he missed most of last season dealing with that injury to his elbow. So we'll see how good he is coming back. Unfortunate that DeGrom is out for, probably going to be a month, but that's kind of just the reality of DeGrom and having him on your roster. With the two Yankees pitchers, Nestor Cortez, he's only got his start pushed back to Monday, but it's just kind of indicative of how unlucky that rotation's been. And of course, Carlos Rodon still not being able to play and having no timetable coming back. And personally, of course, I'm excited about Alex Kirilloff finally coming up. He was raking in AAA in his rehab assignment and also when he got optioned there last week. So it should be fun to see him at first base. He might play some outfield too, but for now, he's going to be the everyday first baseman for the Twins. Well, moving on, we're going to go straight into our performance recaps. Just as a reminder, we get pretty much all our hitter and pitcher highlights from the daily articles over on the Pitcherlist website. The BatterBox and SP Roundup articles are incredible resources to read just to see how players performed each day. But getting right into it, we're going to start with April 28th, last Friday, and we're going to talk about Isaac Paredes, who we actually mentioned a couple weeks ago in the interview on Brandon Drury. Paredes, has a hot bat. He kind of swings between hot and cold. And he looked good on Friday. He went 3-for-4 with two doubles, a home run, two runs, and an RBI. The first hit of the night came in the third with an opposite field double on an 0-1 fastball from Lucas Giolito. And then he came in again in the sixth when it was tied. Another double to left. But he made basically his he caused some big damage in the seventh when he decided to hit a home run off Kendall Graveman. That ultimately proved to be the game changer in that 3-2 win for the Rays. And he is currently tied for second most on the Rays in terms of RBI. So good for Isaac Paredes. Moving on to Saturday, Drew Maggi. If you guys don't know the story of Drew Maggi, he spent 13 years in the minor leagues, bounced around in different systems, including the Twins, I believe. But he's now with the Pirates, and so he finally got promoted on April 23rd. Just a great story here. He was initially hitless in his first four major league at-bats, but coming back, he was the 27th man on for the Pirates doubleheader on Saturday, and he came off the bench and basically, probably did the best that he could do to finish out his major league career. Got two hits, got a double, and his first RBI as well. He was just optioned back to double A, though, so it's a little unfortunate. But, hey, at least the guy was able to kind of fulfill a dream and make it to the majors and get a hit and an RBI. So great for Drew Maggie. And then on Sunday, Cal Raleigh, a.k.a. Big Dumper, 2-for-4 with 2 homers, 3 runs, 4 RBIs, and a walk. Yeah, it was super clutch for Seattle. In the 8th, they were trailing 8-5, and he hit a homer off Anthony Bass. And then in the 9th inning when the game was tied, in the 10th inning when the game was tied, Raleigh came up again and hit another homer to give Seattle the 10-8 lead. Raleigh, you know, is kind of at the bottom tier of a catcher that you would start in a one catcher league. His average is currently .232, so not really anything to write home about. He does have 5 homers on the season, 18 RBI. He is slugging .443. You know, decent walk rate, but the strikeout rate's kind of scary at 30%. Raleigh's still a guy who's, you know, worth keeping tabs on if you need help at the catcher position, because he can run into, you know, a hot streak of homers. He did have 27 last year, so yeah, look for Raleigh if you're looking for catcher help. Moving on to pitchers then, starting on Friday, I'm going to talk about Dustin May, because, man, Dustin May's been really, really tough this year in deciding whether to keep him on rosters or not. He went against the Padres with 5 innings with 2 runs, 3 hits, 4 walks, 4 strikeouts. Not necessarily a terrible start, but the problem is he didn't get a lot of whiffs. He had 9 whiffs total, but only 4 across his secondary whiffs. The sinker wasn't located super well, which is unfortunate. And I think with May, The main thing with him is wanting to see if he can command the ball better, if he can, you know, basically get more swing and strikes, which is, I mean, what you say about all pitchers. But with May, I think we expect a lot more from him, and he's not getting it. So, you know, he's probably some guy that you can definitely drop in a 10-teamer. 12-teamer, you could probably consider if there's someone better out there. And we'll see what happens with May. Maybe he's able to turn it around. The start was against the Cardinals. His next start is against the Padres. Definitely not starting him there. So, you know, we'll see what happens with May. He might be able to turn it around in a couple starts, and he might be worth picking up again. But for now, you're probably okay with dropping him. Moving on to Saturday's game, talking about Nathan Eovaldi, who had a complete game shutout against the Yankees. 9 innings, 0 runs, 3 hits, no walks, 8 strikeouts. Wow. Great start for Eovaldi. Fastball was 97 miles an hour. You know, against the Yankees, obviously, you know, they are dealing with some stuff. I forgot to mention this on the injury report, but Aaron Judge is on the injury list, and that Yankees lineup is not particularly good. But Eovaldi was still able to, you know, do good stuff. When you have a complete game shutout, only give up 3 hits, it's pretty solid. The curveball was probably his best pitch of the night with a 42% CSW. The other pitches, you know, they're all right. He probably was, you know, helped a lot by his defense, because if you look at the strike zone plot, it is pretty much all in the middle. But, you know, that's okay. I think with Eovaldi, kind of expect him to be, you know, a little bit of a ground ball pitcher. He has a you know, decent ground ball rate this year. That hasn't been the start for him his entire career. But yeah, he's been doing really, really well this season. You know, really low walk rate, good CSW rate. The ERA is a little high, but you know, that's just a couple starts here and there that's causing that. So yeah, good for Eovaldi, and good to see that he is doing well. Wrapping up on Sunday, we just talked about Nestor Cortez, and wasn't pretty in his start on Sunday. 4.2 innings, 7 earned runs, 5 hits, 4 walks, 7 strikeouts. The 7 strikeouts are nice, of course, but you don't love the fact that he gave up 7 earned runs. That's just not great. It's kind of weird what's going on with Cortez. I think the 4-seamer just really isn't where it was last year. It only went 1-for-44 on whiffs, wasn't commanded very well. It was kind of all around the zone. The cutter is pretty decent, but Yeah, the four-seamer cutter combination just really isn't working too well, and the secondary stuff isn't as great either. On his sweepers and sliders, he only got 8 strikes on those pitches, throwing 18. Is this sort of like a coming down to earth sort of thing for Cortez? That's definitely possible. I mean, it would be hard for us to expect him to replicate last year's performance, but at the same time, he did have a good season, and so we'd like to expect the same things out of him this year. So we'll see what happens with Cortez as the season goes on. Of course, he got his start pushed back because of strep throat, so we'll see what happens when he pitches on Sunday. Moving on to Monday's games with the Set It and Bishet It article from Gabe Gorelnik for the Batter's Box. We're going to talk about Sean Murphy, who has rocketed up the leaderboards for catchers after basically being not played for a couple of games to start the season. He went 2-for-4 with 2 home runs, 2 runs, and 6 RBI. And yeah, Sean Murphy was great for Atlanta. They had a doubleheader against the Mets. Sean Murphy had a hand in 7 of the team's 12 runs over those 2 games. He's been really solid. I think he's leading this team, the Atlanta, in OPS. So, good for him. And then another guy who we talk about a lot, but maybe not enough, Mookie Betts for the Dodgers. 3-for-5 with a double home run, 2 runs, and 3 RBI. Helping the Dodgers as they scored 13 runs against the Phillies. He was a triple shy of the cycle, but he did have the third hardest hit ball of the game in his single. He took Craig Kimbrell deep with that home run. And even though the StatCast data has been kind of down to start the season, definitely a night like this, it's good to see from Betts to know that he is capable of just kind of doing the insane things that we expect from Betts. Moving on to pitching with the Dom Yankee article from Nick Pollock. We want to start out with Drew Smyly, who pitched a gem against the Nationals. 7 innings, 1 earned run, 6 hits, no walks, 2 strikeouts. Okay, this 2 strikeouts, maybe not the gem part. But the main thing here is that he is executing the Blake Snell blueprint perfectly. The curve is getting everything that you want, except for, whiffs. But that's Drew Smyly. He gets the Marlins today, Saturday. We'll see how that start goes. I don't know if Drew Smyly is, worth keeping on your team. They do go up against Minnesota next, and that could be a little scary. And then I believe it's Houston right after that. So he's probably worth a drop after this start. But he has been doing, decent well in being able to, have 7 shutout innings, or 7 one-run innings, I should say, is not a bad thing. So good for Drew Smyly. And then Blake Snell, 6 innings, 3 earned runs, 8 hits, no walks, 7 strikeouts against Cincinnati. He got 17 whiffs in this one. The curveball was working, 64% strike rate, 48% CSW. Yes, it was a very poor quality start, but it's a lot better than what we've seen from Snell this entire season. So honestly, I'd focus more on the fact that he had 7 strikeouts. He didn't walk anyone. And, as long as he can have a little bit better command with the fastball, have the slider working a little bit more, I think we could see, a little bit of a Blake Snell resurgence. Moving on to Tuesday's games, we're going to start with the Wong Show from Mark Stubinger. It's our BatterBox article. Connor Wong, 4-for-4 with a double, 2 homers, 2 runs, and an RBI for Boston. This was, a matchup between the Red Sox and the Boston, one of those classic AL East slugfests. And Connor Wong's first homer was off Zach Pop, off over the Green Monster. So, pretty solid there. Definitely showing off the power a little bit. And then he basically did the same thing again in the 8th, hitting another homer from Eric Swanson. And that ultimately was the deciding factor. The unfortunate thing, of course, here for the Jays was that Fenway was only one of 2 ballparks where Wong's second homer would have gotten out of the yard. He's slashing .290, .353, .516 this year. One of the hotter batters. We didn't mention him last week, but there's been a lot of hot bats for the Red Sox recently. That game on Tuesday was his 3rd straight multi-hit game. He's got 136 WRC+. He's got catcher eligibility, which is great. The main thing here, of course, is just looking at how often he's going to be playing, because the catching situation is kind of evenly split between him and Reese McGuire. So, you know, he's probably more of a two-catcher league kind of guy rather than someone you want to pick up in a one-catcher league. But, you know, if we track this and, you know, the Red Sox are starting to play Wong more than McGuire, he might be worth picking up even in one-catcher leagues. Moving on, Salvador Perez of the Royals, 2-for-3 with 2 homers, 3 runs, 3 RBIs, and a walk. Just a great game from another catcher who, you know, he had 2 homers in this one. Through the first month, he's been looking, you know, like Salvi. He's hitting .279, .321, .490. He's got 120 WRC plus. The only thing was he was hit during this game went by Anthony Santander, Senator's swing, I should say specifically. But, you know, x-rays came back negative. He's day-to-day with a bruised finger. I think he was able to play again this week. So I don't think there's any true complications from that. Yeah, he hit a homer on Thursday. So, yeah, he should be fine. But, yeah, just something to monitor for Salvi. Yeah, he's been one of the better catchers. You know, he's got 6 homers this season, 36% hard contact rate, which is huge. He is mashing the ball really, really well. You know, there's been a lot saying about, you know, is this his last season in Kansas City? But I think Salvi has been doing a really good job kind of leading that team of young players, and exciting to see where that team goes in the AL Central. As I mentioned, the Tigers are second right now, so it is completely open for anyone. Moving on to pitchers, we're going to start with a cool mill. That's the article from Nick Pollock for the SP Roundup, talking about Bryce Miller, who made his MLB debut, had 5 perfect innings, went 6 innings with 1 earned run, 2 hits, no walks, and 10 strikeouts. Yeah, Bryce is legit. I mean, he was called up straight from Double A. He didn't have the greatest results in Double A. That being said, but the arsenal was great. It's a lot of fastballs. You know, sounds like another Seattle pitcher essentially. He's got a few cutters that, you know, a little could use some work in the command department. It's got the slider as well. But yeah, the main thing is that fastball is really, really good. He had a 40% CSW. Yes, against the Athletics, but it's still hard to ignore 10 strikeouts. If Bryce is able to stay up in the rotation, I think he would definitely be worth a pickup in most of your leagues. He does get Houston tomorrow, Sunday. But, you know, if the matchups are good for him, he's definitely worth starting. And, yeah, we'll see how he fares against Houston. If he really excels in that game, then I think there's no reason to not keep him on your teams. The fun thing was that he went up against Mason Miller, of the A's, who also pitched a gem, 7 innings, 0 runs, 0 hits, 4 walks, and 6 strikeouts. 7 no-hit innings from a rookie. That is pretty solid. The nice thing here, too, was that Oakland let him go to 100 pitches. The slider was elite at a 46% CSW. That might not have been even his best pitch because the fastball was nice at 97. The cutter was really, really looking good. So yeah, I think he's got, definitely a lot of potential here. I think the A's are definitely going to let him run. And the only question is how much of the season are they going to let him pitch, just because he's never been stretched out this long, in terms of, you know, innings in a season. So, you know, we'll see how long Oakland lets him go for, but they have nothing to lose. It would not be surprising if they just say, hey, let's just try this experiment for the entire year. It'll just be interesting to see how that increased workload affects Miller over the course of an entire season. Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we are going to talk about pitchers and batters starting on Wednesday. All right, and we are back. We're going to start with the Batter's Box article, The Walker Dead, from Jim Chatterton. And we're going to start with Marcell Ozuna of Atlanta, 3-for-5 with 2 home runs, 3 runs, 5 RBI. Of course, Ozuna, you know, had some legal issues back in 2021. Also had some injury issues. He had fractured 2 fingers. I think ultimately the domestic violence thing was ultimately cleared of, but definitely affected him as he had an 88 WRC plus in 2022. This season also not great. He's way below the Mendoza line with a batting average of 147, and that's after including this 2-homer game from Ozuna. I don't think he's really worth a spot on your fantasy squads. You know, maybe just keep an eye out for him because he is a really, really solid power hitter. But, you know, if the average isn't there, and frankly, the OBP is not there either, he's only batting two. He's only has a 247 on base percentage as well. It's going to be hard to, you know, rationalize bringing him on your team. A guy who's been really good this season, Josh Jung of the Rangers, went 3-for-5 with also two homers, two runs, and three RBI. He's currently slashing 275, 325, 541. He's got eight homers after this two-run game. You know, the main thing with Jung is just the high strikeout rate, 32.5%. It's not great. It is down from last season, if you can believe it. But the nice thing here is that he's hitting the ball hard. He is lifting the ball. His fly ball rate's now at 40%, which is good in the 81st percentile. 24 RBI as well, so he's doing well in the counting stats department. Yeah, he's definitely a solid third baseman, and especially for that dry position. It's nice to have a contributor, you know, kind of come out of nowhere. Moving on to pitchers, we are reading from the Not What We Thought article from Nick Pollock, the SP Roundup. Of course, talking about maybe one of the more hyped debuts of the season with Brandon Pfaadt going up against the Rangers. It wasn't great, if you could tell from the article title. 4.2 innings, 7 earned runs, 9 hits, 1 walk, 3 strikeouts. Yeah, just incredibly disappointing from a guy who had been doing really well in the minors, actually, and very excited about his debut here. I had him in TGFBI. I was very excited for this start. He does get the Marlins next. So, you know, before we start freaking out, he does have a pretty easy matchup. The Rangers are the second best offense in the majors right now. Also, most of the runs came off 4 homers. Which, you know, I don't think we'd expect him to have that issue for the remainder of the season. The main thing here is that looking at the skill set, it just isn't as elite as the other guys that we're seeing. You know, Tanner Bibee, Bryce Miller, Mason Miller even, Logan Allen has better stuff. The main thing that's going to click here for Pfaadt is his four-seamer. If that is starting to dominate, if we see that to have good returns at that Miami game, then I think it's worth keeping on to him. You know, if obviously he struggles out to Miami, there's no reason to keep him on your rosters. But for now, you know, definitely just hold and see how he does tomorrow. Another guy who's been surprising, wow, a lot of Oakland pitchers today, J.P. Sears. 6 innings, 0 runs, 4 hits, 2 walks, 7 strikeouts. Yeah, Sears was electric. The four-seamer was really, really good, had 12 whiffs on its own. He combined that basically with the sliders, which, you know, weren't as amazing, but, you know, he still got 7 strikeouts, which is great. Didn't have the best command. He does get the Yankees next, and like we mentioned, that offense is not very good, so he definitely is worth starting there. He does get the Rangers and the Astros next, though, so a little scary, but, you know, J.P. Sears is not a guy necessarily that you'd be keeping on your rosters anyway, so, you know, start him in the right matchups, and he might return something really good. Moving on to Thursday's games, we're going to talk, thanks to Seth Kuzmeier for the Furminator article, and we're going to talk about Freddie Freeman. I had no idea who Freddie Freeman was. But obviously, if you are a Kansas City fan, then you know a lot about Freeman. He went 3-for-4 with a triple, a home run, 2 runs, 2 RBIs, and a walk here. Freeman is essentially, I would hesitate to call him a journeyman because he's only 27. But he has, he's a catcher in the system. Minor league career slash line is 269, 353, 417. Not necessarily elite, but, you know, there's definitely maybe some potential here. I highly doubt he's going to have enough starts with the Royals to warrant being on a fantasy roster. That being said, Salvi Perez, you know, the Royals might move on from him, or they might shift him to DH, depending on, you know, what the rest of the team makeup looks like. So Freeman might get more time here in the majors. We'll see. It's something to keep track of, but he clearly has some power, so, you know, good for him. Some other hitters to talk about. Rafael Devers of the Red Sox went 3-for-5 with a double, a homer, a run, and 4 RBI. Triple shy of the cycle, but yeah, whatever. With Devers, he's been amazing this year. Probably the league's best third baseman. It'd be tough for... I definitely wouldn't disagree with that. He's been a big part of why the Red Sox have been as hot as they've been recently. Obviously, we've talked about a lot of other Red Sox pitchers, but you know the main guy here is Devers. You know, essentially quarterbacking that offense. So, you know, good to see from him. Moving on to pitchers, with the Eduardo Leviosa article from Nick Pollock, great name there. The guy we're talking about here is Eduardo Rodriguez, who went 8 innings with 0 runs, 2 hits, 1 walk, and 9 strikeouts against the Mets. He's been great. The main change for him is that he is using the cutter more instead of the slider. It's got a 50% swing strike rate now, and is just getting strikes almost 70% of the time. He's just establishing success with it pretty well. And then just the other pitchers are playing off it pretty solidly as well. The changeup and the four-seamer both had a CSW above 40%. So good for him. And he's got a pretty cushy matchup next. He's got the Guardians, who are currently the worst in Team WRC+, which is kind of interesting. But then he's got the Pirates and the Royals after that. So definitely keep Rodriguez on your rosters. You know, maybe trade him after that. We'll see how sustainable this is. But yeah, he's clearly doing really awesome. And then Zach Eflin of the Tampa Bay Rays going up against the Pirates. 7 innings, 0 runs, 3 hits, no walks, and 10 strikeouts. And he did this all in 80 pitches, which is the crazy part. I was actually thinking about picking up Eflin in one of my leagues, but it's a quality Stark league, and I knew that they were going to limit Eflin. I was like, well, he's probably not going to go to 6 innings and give me a quality start, so I'll pick up someone else. But, man, I kind of regretted that because Eflin was great. Sinker had a 53% CSW. The curve and the cutter were kind of fooling batters the entire night. He's got the Orioles, the Yankees, and the Brewers next, so definitely a guy that you want on your rosters. There's definitely a lot of potential there for him to be good. Well, that's it for the weekly performance recap. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with pitcherless writer Michael Barker about his article, Shaping Up, Starters Who Are Changing Their Arsenals in 2023. And we're back. We're going to be joined by Michael Barker talking about his article about pitch shapes that are changing this season compared to last season. But before we get started, Michael, how are you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
Doing well, doing well. It's glad to finally reach the weekend.
For sure.
Yeah. Why don't you introduce yourself to the podcast? You know, how long you've been playing fantasy baseball? You know, what teams do you root for? Things like that.
Right. Yeah. So I'm Michael. I've been playing fantasy baseball since probably the beginning of the 2021 season, relatively recently. I had kind of kept track of it before. I kind of nerded out on spreadsheets, but I didn't start really playing in leagues until 2021. So this is my third full year of doing it and paying a lot of attention to it. I grew up in Florida, so closest team was the Rays. I'm a Rays fan.
Okay. And that's going pretty well for you this season.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't complain. They've been killing it so far.
That's cool. So any specific types of leagues you enjoy playing, or is it kind of just like a standard redraft that's kind of what you're involved in?
Yeah, so I think the main league that I pay attention to that I'm in a group with a bunch of friends with is started out as a redraft league, but we switched over to like a limited keeper league a couple of years ago. So we just had our first, like, this is our first season of having players we kept from last year. So pretty basic stuff. There's not usually high stakes. I usually just do it for fun, but I get super into it anyways.
Cool. Yeah. Well, that's great. We're going to be talking about your article, Shaping Up, basically talking about starters who changed their arsenals in 2023. Right. I think just really interesting stuff that you have in this article, especially as, you know, people are still trying to kind of figure out who are the guys that they want to kind of key in on early in the season. With like a month and a half of data now on most of these pitchers, it's kind of cool to see that we can, you know, see how pitchers are changing their pitch shapes. So I want to start out with Freddy Peralta, who's the first guy you talk about. One of the things you highlight is his increased velocity on the fastball, as well as, you know, more horizontal sweep on the slider, kind of making it more of that sweeper pitch that a lot of people are talking about nowadays. And those are kind of the reasons he's seeing success. How do those two changes, you know, help both pitchers kind of play off one another even better this year than maybe in the past for Freddie?
Yeah, so I think the main goal for him this season has been to kind of revert back to what he was doing in 2021. He had kind of a rough injury shortened year last year, pitched only around 80-100 innings, something along those lines. And a couple of the changes he made from 2021 to 2022 were, I don't know, not really working out for him. You could see in one of the GIFs I posted in the article, he just had kind of this limited movement slider. It was like down almost 6 whole inches, like half a foot of vertical, horizontal break. He wasn't throwing the fastball quite as hard. It was just a lot of weird stuff going on. It might've been injury related. It might've been some adjustments they had that they wanted to jump ship on this year. But yeah, the main goal was kind of, it looks like he's just trying to move back in the direction he was in 2021. And his slider, I think, is most of the way back in horizontal break. It's up there in the 12 to 14 inches of horizontal run now. And I think the main thing that that does for him is kind of gives him another weapon to attack hitters with on the horizontal plane, because he's really a heavy, like, fastball guy. Like, he's fastball Freddy. He loves attacking guys with fastballs. He threw it over like 50% of the time last year. And I think what he does a lot when he doesn't have a good feel for his off-speed stuff is just go really, really heavy on fastballs and bank on that pitch just getting good results, because it is so strong in terms of like stuff characteristics.
Right.
So yeah, I think he kind of last year got away from his secondary pitches a little bit, leaned a little bit too heavily on the fastball, and hitters were able to kind of limit him to, you know, just changing eye level. He wasn't really able to keep pressuring guys on both sides of the plate laterally. So I think adding more sweep to his slider helped him get back to that point where hitters now can't just go up and down with him. They have to kind of respect both sides of the plate, and the increased fastball velocity. It's really rare that you'll ever see a pitcher increase their fastball velocity and have it be a bad thing. I mean, Don Manaea, I think, has increased his fastball velo a good bit and is seeing not great results this year, but outside of really isolated instances, upping your fastball velo is only going to do good things for you. So just kind of opening up those opportunities for him to attack hitters on both the vertical and the horizontal plane. He's already great at it with the vertical plane with his fastball curveball. And that slider getting back to where it was in 2021, that really opens a lot of a kind of attack patterns for him.
Yeah, it's kind of impressive that he's added nearly 2 ticks of velocity to the pitch, to fastball specifically. And I mean, if you want to maybe say, oh, injury might have sapped some of that power, I mean, it's still a tick higher than it was in 2021, which is pretty impressive. And yeah, this is the two GIFs that you mentioned in the article for Freddie specifically. Obviously, it's a little bit of a different camera angle, but the amount of horizontal movement that he's getting on the 2023 version is a little crazy. Like it literally starts like outside the batter in the batter's box and makes it back into the strike zone, which is
for sure.
Cool.
Yeah. I think it's right in there with, I think it's still classified as a slider on like Savant, pitch leaderboard, all that. But I think it's right in there characteristically where you could call it a sweeper and nobody would question it. So
yeah,
it's a totally new pitch.
That's cool. Well, moving on, someone who's near and dear to my heart this season, Pablo Lopez, is a Twins fan. Definitely been following his stuff this season, and especially the big thing was his addition of the sweeper, slider, you know, whatever you really want to call it here. But Pablo's always been, you know, well known for that fastball changeup combo. And, you know, you mentioned that it could be even better this year. What are some things that you're seeing from his fastball and his changeup that kind of indicate that it could, yeah, it could return even better results this year compared to how elite it's been in the past?
Yeah, so I think when you look at his pitch arsenal and what he's working with this year, the first thing you're obviously going to notice is like that entirely new sweeper. That's the first thing that jumps out at you, and that's the first thing people are going to, it's probably honestly a big amount of the reason that he's had so much success early on is because he's controlling it really well and it has great stuff on it. But that's increased fastball velo really might be like half of the reason that he's doing this well, because I think increasing the velo on his fastball is almost making his changeup more effective by proxy and vice versa. It's just the interaction between those two pitches is so much better this year. I think the whiff rate on both of them is just through the roof. So I think that he added some, I think I want to say he added some vertical movement on his changeup this year, some drop to it, and then increased the velo on his fastball. So this is just like, this is basically impossible for right-handed hitters to get to. Right. And he uses it really effectively against left-handed lefties. So I think kind of just the slight adjustments to his movement profile and his changeup, and then just adding that fastball velocity, and you want kind of the range that he's working with, that velo separation and that movement separation, is kind of ideal for fastball changeup combos, especially for, you know, these power righties who kind of need something like that to get away with, you know, getting through the heart of the order more than twice. So I think the sweeper is doing a lot for him, and he's controlling it really well. He's painting it pretty consistently on the outer third of the plate. But that fastball changeup combo, the interplay between those two pitches is just really improved from last year. I think he's throwing his fastball harder than he ever has, and that's just clearly messing with the timing for a lot of these hitters that are whiffing at his fastball more. They're just late on it. So I think that interplay between the two is really kind of bolstering his performance here early on.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big story in the World Baseball Classic when Pablo came out and was throwing 96 all of a sudden. Everyone's getting super excited, and then, you know, he kind of replicated that in the regular season too so far. So that's been definitely fun to see. And yeah, I think it's always interesting when we talk about fastball changeup combinations, because, you know, some people are inclined to be like, oh, you know, changeup's just a slower fastball, but like you mentioned, he's got more movement on that changeup. And you know, both those pitches probably coming out of his hand look very similar. So being able to, yeah, just get a little bit more break on that changeup, can definitely, you know, result to a lot more success than what he was seeing in the past.
Yeah, the Twins might have something going on over there. I mean, we know the Marlins to be a pretty good pitching development organization, but the Twins they've done some good stuff here with Joe Ryan, Lopez specifically. They have a lot of really good starters. They have more depth in that rotation than I ever remember them having in my lifetime. Yeah. So they've got some secret sauce they're working with over there.
Yeah, it's been fun to watch.
It is fun, yeah.
Yeah. Well, moving on to, you know, the aces of all aces, probably one of your favorite pitchers, Shane McClanahan. It's interesting in your write-up, because I mean, we already know how effective McClanahan is. He's been, you know, essentially like a top five, top 10 pitcher for the last year, 2 years ish. And I think there's a lot of things you mentioned in this write-up, but I think the interesting thing for me was that the curveball has less movement. But in kind of the way you saw it, that's actually leading to maybe better results, which right. I think sometimes we think like, oh, you know, more movement equals a better pitch. So yeah, could you maybe talk about it a little bit? But how's the decrease in movement end up helping his curveball more in this case?
I think a lot of the guys, I've been thinking about this a lot too, and I'm trying to work out the reason. I'm not sure there's a ton of research into curveball movement specifically and how that correlates to performance, especially for a guy like Shane. But I think something I suspect is that a lot of these guys that have like classically kind of big loopy curveballs don't have a lot of other weapons in their arsenal that they can lean on. So guys like, you know, Adam Wainwright, he's got what, like a mid to high 80s sinker outside of his curveball, maybe a changeup, just really not like overpowering stuff outside of the curveball, which is always graded out really well. And so I think what might be happening is with Shane specifically, he has so many other weapons at his disposal that he doesn't need this big loopy left-handed curveball. I think that might actually hinder him in this case, because he has the changeup that just the changeup slider kind of mirror each other on the horizontal axis. And then the fastball is just this insane running, rising monstrosity that comes in the upper 90s. Yeah. He doesn't need this big loopy curveball to get chases. Mm-hmm. He can really use that pretty effectively to just drop it in the strike zone. I can't tell you how many times I've been watching him, and he just, like, the sequence of pitches is, it's so repeatable. He dots like a 97 mile an hour fastball in the zone for strike one, and then freezes guys the very next pitch to get to 0-2 on a curveball. He just drops that into the strike zone so reliably. So I almost feel like taking some movement off of both axes on that pitch is almost making it harder to identify for hitters,
Yeah.
and so they're letting it go a lot more. And I did mention that the chase rate on it is up, but he doesn't even necessarily use it as like this chase put away pitch. Most of the time, that's the change up against right-handed pitchers, and he'll usually just try to overpower lefties with the fastball. So I think it's kind of just this, like a lot of these pitch changes, it's tinkering to make it a little bit better in how it interacts with all the rest of his pitches, and kind of specifically his other off-speed offerings. It just makes it a little bit less discernible from a lot of his other offerings, and righties can't really just like identify it out of the hand and sit on it, wait for it to drop into the zone and drop it into right field. You know, it's a pitch that they almost are forced to freeze and just watch go by and hope it misses the strike zone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me, we had a couple weeks ago we had a conversation on Nick Pivetta, and one of the things that he's done with his curveball this year, granted the results haven't necessarily been there the same way they've been for
Right, yeah.
Shane, but it was basically that his curveball for last year was going basically moving from out of the zone to into the zone to out of the zone. And so if a batter saw that it was the curveball or recognized that it was the curveball coming, they just lay off it because they knew it was going to be a ball. And so one of the changes we talked about is that, oh yeah, the curveball actually now he's tightened it up a little bit and it stays longer in the zone. So batters just have to think about it a little bit more before they're willing to be, take the pitch or swing. And I think kind of what you're saying here with Shane's curveball is a little similar where, yeah, that you can add a little bit more deception to it, make it look more like his other off-speed pitches, and just keep batters guessing and not knowing what's coming next.
Yeah, I think that's a general trend that we're probably going to see a lot more with starting pitchers, is that curveballs are kind of shifting away from these big put away chase pitches that get swings and misses a ton, and more called strike weapons, just things you can reliably drop into the zone and command well, to kind of freeze batters. I mean, the Rays specifically, the only starting pitcher they have on their roster right now that uses a curveball in a more conventional way is Zach Eflin. And all their young guys right now, if they do have a curveball like a Taj Bradley, it's not anywhere near the focal point of their arsenal. It's kind of more of a called strike weapon. So I think that they're probably trying to figure out exactly what movement profile optimizes that effect of that pitch in particular.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's kind of nice that you mentioned Zach Eflin because you also wrote about him in your article, and he obviously just came off an amazing start on Thursday, where yeah, I was a little bummed because I was thinking about picking him up, and I'm in a quality start league, and I was like, ah, I don't know if he's going to get to 6 innings on a 80 or 85 pitch limit, and lo and behold, he goes 7 shutouts. So shows how much I know about pitching. But
Seven.
Eflin's one of those guys where I think a lot of people were, mixed feelings about him because he ended up last year in the Phillies rotation. They weren't starting him in the playoffs at all. Then he goes and signs his contract with the Rays, and all of a sudden everyone's like, oh, maybe the Rays saw something in him. And we know how much the Rays love to tinker with their guys. So his draft stock, was both up and down, I guess, depending on how much you believed in the coaching staff in Tampa Bay. But yeah, since the article's come out, there's been well now 3 starts for Eflin. What are you liking from him? What are you liking from his? What changes are you seeing in his pitch shapes from last year that might be leading to more success or maybe evidence that there might be something good coming for Eflin this season?
Yeah, he's one of the most interesting pitchers I've watched this year, and I've watched pretty much all of his starts because I watch as many Rays games as I can. I hate to oversimplify it, but I really think, like, if the Rays ever go out and give a starting pitcher a multi-year contract, you know, not one of these like Corey Kluber signings, not one of the, you know, they'll always bring in a veteran or two on a low risk 1 year deal, but when they go out and like jump the market and give, you know, Zach Eflin a multi-year contract, or Charlie Morton back in 2019, it's probably safe to assume that he's going to unlock something. I mean, they're just so good at doing that at this point. So yeah, I was pretty high on him. I wrote about him earlier as like an underrated value, and it sounded like most of the reason I said that was because he signed with the Rays, which wasn't really founded in anything concrete. But I did point out that He's always been such a good command guy, and it's kind of interesting that the Rays targeted him so heavily because they usually like to bring in these crazy stuff guys and then just get
Right.
them to pound the zone with their stuff. But he's kind of almost the inverse. Like a lot of that work is done for them. He has like six, he had what, five, six pitches he could command really well coming into this year. So there was just like endless room for them to play with. And so I think one of the things that I kind of correctly predicted was that they were going to optimize his fastball mix depending on whether he was facing righties or lefties. He's throwing pretty much exclusively cutters to lefties, sinkers to righties. And they've also done something super weird to his changeup. I mentioned it in the article. It's like it's coming in softer, it's not dropping quite as much, and it's adding a lot of horizontal movement, but it's getting significantly better results. It's almost like he's throwing it with the intention of a four seamer, and it's acting a little bit more like a four seamer, but maybe there's something they saw in the separation of it between his other pitches and maybe his two fastballs that just makes it impossible to identify. But yeah, he's just this insane command guy that they had so many avenues that they could go. I thought maybe they would ditch his curveball slider mix for kind of a sweeper, sweeper cutter mix, like a lot of guys are doing. But yeah, clearly the results are there. He's doing pretty much exactly what I think the Rays and a lot of fantasy owners wanted him to do, which is pound the zone, get more whiffs than I think a lot of us expected. And his pitch mix, I think, has a lot to do with that. And there really haven't been that many huge movement profile adjustments. It's mostly been usage and honing that command in.
Yeah. It's like you mentioned this in the article kind of in passing, but I was looking at Eflin's stats too. You mentioned that, using the sinker and the cutter kind of, almost specifically against righties and lefties, could result in a lot of weakly pulled ground balls, is what you say in the article. And I just took a look at his ground ball rate. It's 58%. Which is good for 16th in the majors right now. And it's a huge jump from where he was last year at 47%. I guess it's working as intended because the stats seem to show that he is getting a lot of ground balls with maybe this change in the pitch mix and relying more on the cutter and the sinker.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he might have been leaning a little bit too hard trying to go for the, riding four seamer approach in Philadelphia. And the Rays just said, I mean, the Rays do this all the time with guys who have sinkers, is that like if you have a sinker, throw it a lot to the same sided hitters. If you're a righty with a good sinker, throw it to righties all the time. So I think the Rays just saw like, oh, he has three kinds of fastballs. Two of them are kind of underutilized right now. So let's just kind of split this down the middle and use that sinker and cutter to pressure the inner half of the plate and just get a ton of weak contact instead of trying to miss bats with the four seamer. And I think that approach is working wonderfully right now for him.
Yeah, the strike zone plot's actually kind of impressive on the sinker. There's like I think less than 10 that are on the I guess glove side technically portion of the plate for Eflin. He's basically just all locating the arm side, which is kind of cool.
I just think he's this weird guy that entered free agency a little bit young for starting pitchers. I think he's like 20, he was 27 in the offseason, 28 now. They felt good bringing him to a multi-year deal, and he commands all his pitches really well. So, I mean, this kind of seemed like a layup when he signed with the Rays. Like, yeah, he's going to go undervalued in the draft
Right,
market right
exactly. Yep.
now.
Yeah. I kind of want to ask another question here because you mentioned him in passing, and you're a Rays fan, so I figured you probably could speak a little bit more to it. How good is Taj Bradley's fastball?
I think coming up through the minor leagues, the big talking point with him was kind of the gyro slider cutter mix, and rightfully so. He commands that really well, and he manipulates the shape on those really well. But I don't think anybody, even myself, saw how incredible his fastball was just as like a primary offering. I mean, I'm writing an article right now about some of the rookie starting pitchers, the top prospects we've seen debut, and kind of what they're working with and what they might need to adjust. And the main thing I kept coming back to with Taj was that his fastball is such an overpowering offering in terms of characteristics. I think in terms, if you just look at Stuff Plus, it's the third best fastball in baseball right now with a minimum of 100 or so thrown. And the two guys ahead of him are Strider and DeGrom. So it's just like, it's this typical kind of rising fastball, almost like a, I wrote another article about Pete Fairbanks and how ridiculous his fastball is.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of has a little bit of that in it. It's like almost 20 inches of vertical break, comes in well above 95 miles an hour on average. And I don't know. I think he's going to be really special if he can figure out kind of an optimal mix of off-speed offerings, whether that's the circle change or the curveball. Because that fastball cutter slider mix is he could probably be a decent starter right now. But if he figures out those other secondaries, then I don't know, sky's the limit for him.
Yeah, totally. We spent a good 15 minutes last week on the pod talking about how we basically recommend Taj Bradley on all your teams. Then, of course, then the Rays are like, oh, we're going to send him down for a couple of weeks. And now we don't know when he's coming back.
It's a little weird. I don't know. That's just something the Rays like to do. They like to maximize their roster flexibility. If a guy has options, they'll probably use them. So I don't know. That's just something you're probably going to have to live with, but I wouldn't think it'd be too long before he's back up. I think they probably just wanted to use that excuse of getting him on a 5-day schedule so he could go work on his curveball and changeup mostly in kind of a low stakes setting, but sure. he shouldn't be down for too long.
All right. Well, we look forward to him coming back up, and that Rays rotation is looking a little scary. So, your team is just looking scary in general. But the wealth of pitching is fun to watch.
Yeah, it's been a ride so far. Fingers crossed they don't get bit by the injury bug like they did last year.
Yeah, exactly. The Yankees at the bottom of the AL East and the Rays at the top. Who would have thought?
Yeah. Right.
All right. Well, thanks again, Michael, for coming on and talking about your article on starter tour changing their arsenals in 2023. Definitely recommend guys to check it out because we talked about several pitchers here, but there's some write-ups here on Lodolo, who I know a lot of people, drafted really high early season, and then now, we'll see what happens with Lodolo. JP Sears is a fun name that you mentioned here. Obviously, not a lot of people are excited about Oakland in general, but Sears has some potential there to be a guy on your fantasy teams. Definitely check that out. But before we head off, Michael, what are some things that are coming up for you with PitcherList? And if you got a Twitter, how can people reach out and get a hold of your content?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm working on kind of a just big write-up piece of all the good rookie pitchers we've seen so far: Bradley, Fott, Bybee, Allen, all those guys. So that should be coming in the next couple of weeks, I want to say. Yeah, should be coming kind of mid-May-ish. My Twitter is just my last name backwards, kind of RecRab, MB. So I've got a lot of stuff going on with PitcherList. Going to keep writing going deep articles. I love talking about pitching, and rookie starters are up next for me.
All right, sounds good. We'll definitely look forward to that because some of the rookies have been impressive, and then you had Brandon Fott start this week, which was, I think, pretty disappointing for a lot of people.
That was rough for me too, because I started him on a whim after I picked him up because I've been holding him for 2 weeks. So
yeah,
I don't know. He'll figure it out. He has good stuff.
Right. Yeah, I drafted him in TGFBI, but I didn't want to start him this week because rookie debuts are never really a good sign. But hopefully he turns it around.
Yeah, I think he will.
All right. Well, thanks, Michael. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Yep. No problem.
All right. Thanks again, Michael. We're going to go on to the streamers for this week. A lot of interesting names here, but there's three I'm going to focus on. Starting with Tanner Bibee of the Guardians. He has a two-star week, Monday against Detroit and then Sunday against the Angels. Honestly, I do hesitate to call Bibee a streamer option. He's rostered in nearly half of Yahoo leagues. He's only rostered in 70% of ESPN leagues, though, so there's a good chance he might be available in the league you're in. Again, it's a two-start week against pretty soft opposition. His stuff is nice, even though he hasn't reached 6 innings yet. He's got good strikeout potential. He hasn't walked anyone yet either, so good command. Definitely stuff to build on for a couple easy starts. Peyton Battifield is the next guy of the Guardians. He goes against Detroit on Wednesday. Just another Guardians pitcher. Battenfield is not as elite as the other guys, but you know, he's had a few okay starts this season. In his first season in the majors, he did just have a good outing against the Twins. He was perfect through five innings before giving up a two-run homer to Max Kepler. Ultimately, still finished with seven strikeouts in seven innings. So against you know, a worse team like Detroit, I'd expect him to feast. And then finally, Rich Hill of the Pirates goes up against Colorado also on Wednesday. He had a poor start against the Jays, but before that, he was on a personal three-game winning streak against pretty soft opposition as well. Yeah, he tends to do well against bad teams, and this Colorado team is not very good. No offensive pop whatsoever, so expect him to contribute as a pretty good streamer. There's a bunch of other guys, too. You know, like I mentioned earlier, Bryce Miller goes against Detroit on Saturday. Carlos Carrasco goes against the Nationals also on Saturday. That'll be his first start back from the IL, of course, so there's a little caution there. Adrian Hauser goes against the Royals on Sunday. That's more of like a good matchup, not say, you know, more indicating that Hauser is back. And then Brandon Pfaadt, like you mentioned, goes against Miami on Tuesday. You know, there might be people who have dropped Pfaadt after his pretty awful outing against the Rangers, and so this might be an opportunity to pick him up and see how he does here. But yeah, plenty of options for you to check out, and definitely be checking out articles on PitcherList, especially the Sit Start article that comes out on Sundays, where you just basically get to see the landscape for the next week and what pitchers you should be picking up. Well, that's it for our pod today. You can find us again at ThisWeekPL on Twitter. You can send us your comments and questions at thisweekplpod@gmail.com. You can find me at Twitter at TheJohnKa. And you can follow Lee at Regicidal. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the PitcherList podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcast, and leave us a 5-star review if you enjoy the show. Lastly, sign up for PitcherList Plus. By doing so, you can join us in the PitcherList Discord, get advice from all the fantasy experts and writers over there. Well, that's all for this week, and we will be back next week with both Lee and I on another episode of This Week in Fantasy Baseball. See you in the next one. Later, everyone.